approach that we have to managing user requests and requirements for new software, disruptive software if you like, because we're moderately unusual in HE in that we develop more or less all of our own stuff. We've done content management and VLE stuff, we've done discussion groups, authentication, web forms and online assessment, and latterly blogs. And we use a particular development approach called Agile development, which formed the basis for the title of my talk, being Agile. I should say now, though, that I'm not proposing to talk about the technical details of Agile development. There are some particular requirements relating to it, like unit test coverage and deploy cycles and documentation. And that's not really what I'm going to talk about today. But if anyone was coming along thinking, I really want to know about that stuff, then I'm happy to talk about it later. But I'm more interested in questions about if you are in a position where you write all your own software, then on the face of it, that sounds kind of ideal for managing new requirements from users, because you're not necessarily bound by the problem of does the package that we've got do this, or can we go out and buy a package that does this? In principle, if someone comes along and says, I would like X, and you have the capability to develop new things, then you ought to be able to provide X. So it sounds on the face of it as if this would be great. And the answer is that it is. And yet it isn't, it turns out. But before I get into that, I should go back to where I started from. When Brian first contacted me about this, he said, "Will you? I'm doing this day on disruptive technologies, would you come and talk?" And I said, "Sure, but what do you want me to talk about?" He said, "Well, that blog stuff, you should talk about the blogs and disruptive technologies." And I said, "Okay, got it. Blogs, disruptive technologies, leave it with me." And I sat and I thought, and when I came to write, I sort of froze in my fingers like this and thought, "I've got nothing. Damn it." And so I'm just not trying hard enough. Try harder. And what I ended up writing was this. And I thought to myself, this isn't what Brian wants at all. This is not going to be good. But then I thought, but doesn't that make it all the sweeter somehow? And I think the thing that interests me is that I don't necessarily myself perceive the idea that there are disruptive technologies in HE. For clarity's sake, I should say that I think there are disruptive technologies, and I think there are industries and situations where technology is highly disruptive. If you were a bookseller in the late 1990s, if you were a full-service stock dealer in the late 1990s, then you either got on the technology train or you were in a world of hurt. But in HE? Well, maybe. HE goes back a really long way. Universities date to what? 1250, 1259? So they've seen an awful lot of technologies along the way, and pretty much every one of them has been characterized by someone who stands up and says, this technology is disruptive, this technology is shattering our paradigm, or it's going to change the way we do business forever, or whatever. In the 1950s, someone at Cambridge said it about television. In the 1980s, someone at Harvard said it about the VCR. Once you've got VCRs, why would you do lectures anymore? You just turn the tapes out. It's disruptive. There aren't going to be no more lectures. We had a guy from Intel swing by a few years ago when we were thinking about our e-strategy stuff, and he was kind enough to reuse for us a quote which I gather he's used a lot around the place, which is about the idea that technology is so transformative and so disruptive that if you're not in e-business in the next 3 years, you're out of luck. That was 6 years ago, and it turns out, not strictly speaking, to be the case that you had to be in e-business by 2003 or it was game over. So I think my assertion in the general case is that it's not necessarily right to think about disruptive technologies. I would suggest that the right way to think about new technologies that come along, and we might be talking about blogs or wikis or Skype or whatever it is not in terms of disruption, but in terms of accretion. New stuff accretes around the outside of the old stuff. We haven't stopped doing lectures and seminars, in fact, we do more than ever, just because we can also now stream video to our students. We might choose to do the streaming of the video to our students, but that's a thing that we stick on top of everything else that we do. Not much of what we do historically gets replaced. Some things here and there, but they're kind of minority things. In the general case, all of the new stuff that we might like to think is going to be disruptive and world-shattering and changing, actually that's rarely true. At my own institution, and your mileage may vary, if HTTP broke tomorrow, lots of people would be really annoyed. The marketing people would be furious, because actually the way we market ourselves mostly these days is kind of on the web. And I guess our admin people would be pretty cross as well, because I think quite a lot of our workflows and so on are managed through sort of web interfaces. But the teaching and learning people wouldn't really mind. They would carry on lecturing, they'd carry on giving seminars, they might have to run off a few more photocopies, which would be a bit of a pain. But fundamentally, if HTTP went away tomorrow, our teaching and learning wouldn't be altered that much. And I'm not saying that's generally true. There may be institutions where no HTTP means disaster. Nobody can learn anything anymore. But I struggle to see how that's true, personally. So, the really interesting question, I think, if you once I decided that actually I couldn't say anything on the subject of disruptive technologies and I had to let that go and move on, is how do you choose what to do? we are in a situation ourselves where, like most IT providers, I guess, and most IT institutions, people come along to us all the time and say, what I would really like is X. Doesn't really matter what X is. It might be a wiki, it might be that they want to experiment with blogs, it might be that they want new authentication services or search services. There are always lots and lots and lots of X's. In fact, there are more X's realistically, and if anyone wants to contradict me here, I would be delighted to hear it, than any IT function realistically can hope to support. So nobody's ever going to be able to say, yeah, I've got an almost infinite sea of developers or business analysts or whoever it is waiting to either build or buy or otherwise acquire the thing that you're interested in. There are always choices to be made. And so really, I guess, these choices are the same choices that they've always been. And new technologies, old technologies, not technologies at all. The questions that we're asking ourselves when we try to decide, should we build a wiki for this guy over here, or should we help this guy over here who wants to have PowerPoint animations running on the web, is about the cost benefits, it's about the opportunity cost. If we do this, we can't do that. Which one should we do? Which one's more important? Which one's riskier? And that's an interesting question, because sometimes high return things are necessarily also high risk things. So we think about those things too. And so when I try to set out and articulate the principles that I think we try to be guided by in our so-called agile development, but we want to be responsive to our users, we want to build the things that are going to deliver most value, is first of all, trivially obviously, people do what they want to do, and forgive me for the kind of first year psychology insight, but we've actually made a number of mistakes along the way where we've gone ahead and we've implemented something on the basis that it seemed like the right thing, it seemed pedagogically sound, or it seemed like it had a crucial business function. But we didn't ask ourselves the question, do people actually want to do this? I'll give you a particular example. We've built a blogging platform, which I'll show some screens on in a little while. And we were very keen to make sure that our blogging platform was academically focused. And so we said, we need functions that will make this thing be an academic platform, not just a place where people go and write any of this stuff. And we thought and thought and thought about this, and we came up with the idea of blog prompts, where academics could, as it were, post a prompt into people's blogs that would say, I would like you to do some blog entry stuff about last week's history seminar, or about how you feel now that you're at the end of the first term. Then we were very proud of ourselves for this, and we patted ourselves on the back and said, that's brilliant, that's blogging, but with an academic twist. Good work, fellas. Let's go down the pub. But we were quite wrong, and we were quite wrong because we overlooked this one question. Do students want to answer prompts? If you had a blog somewhere and somebody posted a message in it saying, this is what I'd like you to blog about now, I'm guessing you wouldn't think, oh, right, I'll get right on it. You're probably thinking, what? Who are you? How did you get in here? Call security. And this turns out to be true. Our academic colleagues weren't that keen on sending blog prompts to students, and our students weren't that keen on responding to them. So despite the fact that it seemed like a good idea, it seemed kind of pedagogically sound, it didn't turn out to actually work. So we are guided to some extent by the principle, are we sure that there are people out there who want this? Are we sure that there are people out there who, if we delivered this to them, would say, yes, this exactly meets my needs? And there's two ways you can do that, I guess. You can either say, well, someone's come and asked for this, ergo someone wants it. Or you can be a bit more kind of self-confident and say, no one's actually asked for this, but I'm dead sure that when people see this, they will say, this is exactly what I needed. I didn't know it before, but now that you've shown it to me, I've seen the light, I'm going to use it. Clearly, the second is riskier than the first. And don't force people to do things that they don't want to do, because it turns out that it doesn't matter whether it's good for them or not. We have a huge debate raging internally at the moment about chat servers. We have some academics who are fervently of the belief that they want to support chat for groups of students and seminars and things like that. And we have a group of our e-learning advisors who are dead sure that pedagogically chat is wrong, that somehow it's not the right solution for this particular problem, and that the best way to fix this would be using some other technological approach or trying to fix the problem some other way. So who should win out? We've got the pedagogy guys on one hand saying, no, 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 chat is wrong, chat is not what you want. And we've got the academics on the other hand saying, yes, it is. Who are you? Who let you in here? And I think it's right to have the debate. I think it's right to sort of say, okay, maybe there is a pedagogic argument here that says this stuff is not the right solution for this problem. But I think you ignore people saying, this is what I want to do at your peril. And by saying, well, you may want to do that, but we're giving you this, it's going to be difficult. So one of the things that we do quite a lot of, for instance, is when we're trying to think about whether we're going to build something, sorry, this screen is a bit dark and dingy, but we go out and we show people, or we talk to people about what we're trying to build, and we try to get them to say, yes, if you gave me this tool, I would do X, Y, and Z, but I would not do this, and I don't really value these things, but I value those things, and so on. So we we have slightly more confidence before we start building things that there is at least some evidence to suggest that people want them or will use them in the way that we had anticipated. So we end up with two choices. Two things you know that people want. Or deliver stuff in an open-minded sort of way and be prepared for people to then actually take whatever you've made and delivered for them and use it in ways that you didn't necessarily want or intend or expect. I've got a couple of examples that I'd like to show you. The first one is a physical facility, actually. It's not a piece of software at all. I hope I'm not too far off topic here. A couple of years ago, we built a new student lab-type facility, which we call the Learning Grid. And we were very keen for it to be completely unlike our other computer facilities. It's 24-hour, it's open access. There are as few restrictions on what you can do there as we can possibly get away with. You can take your mobile in, you can make calls, you can receive calls, you can take food and drink in there. All the furniture is on casters, and the screens and dividers are all mobile, and the projectors and plasmas and clever boards and everything else are all completely reconfigurable. So you can go in there, and in principle, you can just munge the place around until it's as you want it to be. So if you've got a group of six people and you're preparing your presentation for some kind of piece of coursework, you can grab tables and chairs and a projector and wheel them around and put them where you want them and how you want them to do what you want. We've got presentation rooms in there where there are lecterns so that people can practice giving presentations, and you can video record what's going on in there and so on. But we're completely unprescriptive about it, or at least as far as we can be. We try to say to students, if you want to go in there and rehearse Henry IV Part 1, that's okay. If you want to go in there because you're just looking for a place to have a natter and drink Diet Coke, we're okay with that too. And the test results for this are kind of through the roof. We have the kind of feedback from students that you just cannot buy. I've got quotes that say things like, you know, I wouldn't go to a university that didn't have a learning grid. You know, it was when I saw the learning grid on my open day tour that I decided that Warwick was a place for me. This kind of thing. It's great. But it's also very, very tricky to strike the right balance between giving people what they want, which is the freedom to do absolutely anything, and managing the facility in a way which is unintrusive but effective. You would not believe the number of pizza boxes that we clear away each morning from this place, for instance. And we have groups that get loud and raucous, and we have student advisors whose job is to try to manage that. But they don't manage it by saying, you may not make this amount of noise. They manage it by kind of negotiating between the group that's making noise and the group near them who are kind of bothered by the noise. And that's a much more difficult, time-consuming process. So on the one hand, we've given people what they want and it's immensely popular. But on the other hand, it turns out that there's no such thing as a free lunch. It takes much more effort and time to look after something like that. My second example is from a blogging system that we offer at Warwick. We have the option for every student and every member of staff to have a blog, and we're agnostic about what they do with it. We'd like to think that there are some students who will use it to help their studies. They might use it to reflect on their work and their progress through university. There might be other students who choose to use it purely recreationally, and we're okay with that too. One of the interesting things that happens is that our academic colleagues have found applications for it that we didn't expect. This is a chemistry lecturer who is taking questions from his students and answering them. The reason this is mildly interesting is because what he values about blogs is the ability to comment anonymously. You can't tell who these people are, and Lala is not really Lala at all, it turns out. And it never occurred to us that anonymous commenting had any particular academic merit. But it turns out to this academic that his students are, whether they're shy or withdrawn or just self-conscious, but his problem that he turned out to solve in this way was that his students weren't coming forward to ask the questions that he felt that they needed to ask and he needed to answer. And this turned out to be a platform that let him do that, which was unexpected but interesting. We have somebody else, a lecturer in our English department, who has moved her entire corpus of material from out of what we might loosely call our VLE and into a blog instead, because it agrees with her rather more. Now, on the one hand, I think that's great. I think people should have the freedom and the option to use whatever of our technologies they want in whatever way they see fit. On the other hand, it means that our VLE picture is a little bit more fuzzy and messed up than it was before. Instead of saying with some confidence, all your modules are here, now we're saying some of your modules are here, and some of them are over there on a blog. So we now have an extra thing to think about and to worry about a little bit, which is, as we provide these tools for people to do whatever they want with, are they going to use them in ways which, A, we didn't expect, and B, which messes around a little, messes around is putting it too high, but we have to react to and respond to and find ways to work around. And not only do people do things which are unexpected and cause you to have to sort of rethink what you might do a little bit, but people do things which are, in some senses, problem-causing and difficult. This is a relatively modest example. We had a member of our administration who had a blog, and as you can probably see, I guess, she says she's moving her blog to a third-party provider, Blogspot or whatever, because I've come to a point where I feel more comfortable with not having all my colleagues have easy access to my blog. Interesting. So someone starts out thinking I want a blog at the institution and then says, actually, I don't want all the people who I work with in the morning coming in and reading whatever it is I have to say about my life and what I've been doing. Slightly more amusingly still, we had some feedback from colleagues at another university following the talk I did in Manchester, actually. Again, I don't know if this text is clearly visible to you, but someone from another institution writes to his colleague, I was surprised to see you promoting the blog site at the University of Warwick. Having visited the site, I found numerous examples of unmoderated filth with a decidedly reactionary slant. Now, I'm not thrilled about the unmoderated filth, but I'm quite proud of the reactionary slant. I think that's I am contacting George Galloway MP, who I believe is maliciously slandered and libelled on these unmoderated blogs. Turns out our students aren't big fans of George Galloway. And, you know, when we had our checklist of what will happen if we give students blogs, slandering George Galloway wasn't on the list anywhere. And yet, there is maybe a problem there. We haven't, as yet, haven't found ourselves having to explain our unmoderated policy in court, so that's that. It's not a problem in the sense that we believe there's a legal issue here. It's a problem in the sense that there are unexpected consequences of doing things. This is actually a message from me on somebody's blog that says, after some debate, the university has removed the images in question from this blog entry. The discussion has been a thoughtful and interesting one, but our view is that the potential of the images to offend outweighs the value of reproducing them. Who wants to guess which images they were? It turns out that, like every institution, our students have views about the whole Prophet Muhammad question, and it turns out also that our students are not shy about sharing those views. And the interesting thing about it is that there was nothing frivolous or trivial about what was being done here. The student who posted this was himself a Muslim student who said, I think that people should see these images in order that we can have a debate about whether they really are offensive and what the context is. I think that's laudable. I think academically it's interesting and it's got merit, and the discussion was a good one. But as an institution, do we want to be an institution that hosts that kind of content? It's a hard question. HSBC Bank contacted us a little while ago. This to point out that when you do a search on Google Images for HSBC, the very first image you get comes from blogs.org.uk. To their surprise and delight. Satire? Defamation? Fair use? Who decides? It turns out, actually, that HSBC, ironically enough, supply our affinity card. So it was not just like, we're not happy about this because we don't think it's very nice. It's, how could you do this to us? We give you your affinity card. So we had to fix that. All of which, I guess, and I only have 20 minutes, so I should wrap up fairly quickly, is to say that the way that new technologies are disruptive is not in the sense that they displace old technologies. It's because they quite often have unintended consequences and unexpected side effects. But that said, I think there is some merit in trying to support the people who do this sort of stuff. And my three-point test, I guess, for how well one is able to be reactive and responsive to people who want new things, and who can resist alliteration, I guess, is being responsive. The first part of our job that I guess is difficult is making sure that our academic colleagues have some way of getting in touch with us and some way of saying, these are the things that I would like to do, these are the things I would like you to support. And we have people whose job is to do that, and we invest a certain amount of time and money in it. But the next R, I guess, is risk averse. By definition, I think embracing new technologies and allowing people to use them for whatever purposes they want entails a measure of risk. And there are some institutions which I think entirely appropriately have said, no, actually, we're not comfortable with that kind of risk. We would rather not deploy all this new stuff without being quite clear about what it's for, because we're not quite sure what the consequences would be, and we don't like being not sure about consequences. My own institution is relatively relaxed about that, and I've been impressed by the extent to which our senior management have said, we're okay with the idea that as well as good and interesting and useful functions, some of this stuff may not turn out to be quite so good and useful, and so on. And trivially, of course, rich. It turns out that supporting more platforms and more technologies and building more applications or buying more software and then supporting it is an expensive process. So the extent to which one can be agile, I think to some extent, is a function of the extent to which one is prepared to throw cash at the problem. And despite having completely ignored my brief and my mandate, that was what I had to say about being agile. Thank you.
Thank you, and time for two quick questions. Oh.